So I'll tell you about the CDMS, Direct Dark Matter Search. Physics motivation has been covered in great detail. The one thing I'd like to draw your attention to is the Milky Way's rotation curve itself, which somehow I'd never seen very often. But there's where the Earth is, and of course it holds flat and even rises. It'd be terrible if our galaxy didn't have dark matter in it, but all the ones we looked at did. Again, it's been discussed, the sort of WIMP nucleon cross-sections of interest, about 10 to the minus 42 centimeters or so. Here's the DAMA allowed region these days in WIMP mass versus cross-section. The existing CDMS limits from about 2 years ago indicating cross-section below that, and a bunch of models, and there's been a lot of discussion of this. Direct detection works by something, a weakly interacting particle, essentially imparting its velocity to a nucleus, and the nucleus recoils. And that velocity is characteristic of the rotation curve, about 10 to the minus 3 compared to the speed of light. And that just happens to be at sort of the Bragg peak for ionization. It gives you really dense ionization. In contrast, the one of the dominant backgrounds, probably the dominant were it not for some detector tricks, would be if the cousin of the neutralino, the photon, did the same thing. And of course, it interacts with the electron instead because there's a large Compton wavelength for the electron. And the electron recoil is much, much faster. And so you're near min-I, and you deposit your ionization, or energy, I should really say, over a much larger distance. So there's a sparse energy deposition. So what we try to do in CDMS, as in Edelweiss, is use the density or sparsity of energy deposition as a basis of discrimination. One thing is that neutrons can cause the same sort of recoil that WIMPs would, but the cross-section for that is 10 to the 20th times higher. So it's possible to shield that in a variety of ways. And also, you know, the cross-section is so high that the neutrons will often multiply interact in your detectors. And so one can use that if one thinks there's neutrons. So here's a plot of the rate above some threshold, so the integrated rate above some threshold per kilogram per day for a variety of targets that are commonly used. And for the total cross-section, which is the value along the vertical axis, goes crudely as a squared. Now, it's not just coherence that's doing that. Actually, there's a contribution for reduced mass that gets in there. In any case, heavier targets are better at zero recoil. The slope of this curve is some combination of the Maxwell-Boltzmann of WIMPs in the galaxy and the reduced mass, except when you get to really big nuclei like xenon, which actually diffract off the WIMP, if you like. And there's a faster drop in the integrated cross-section. But you can see, as Philippe had said earlier, the game's pretty much over, at least for 100 JeV WIMPs, by about 50 keV. And then if the WIMPs are much, much more massive, then these curves flatten out a bit. Okay. And the size for a 10 to the minus 42 cross-section, centimeter squared cross-section, is something like an event per kilogram per day. There's a CDMS collaboration, and CDMS stands for Cryogenic Dark Matter Search. We operate 20, 30 millikelvin in that range. We use both germanium, and because of the higher cross-section, that's to detect WIMPs predominantly, and silicon, which is has actually a higher cross-section for detecting neutrons and a much lower one for detecting WIMPs. Of course, we start to see a signal. It would be very interesting to compare the WIMP cross-sections for these things, but more or less at the moment, our silicon is there as a background detector. And we simultaneously measure charge, and the heat or phonons are from nuclear recoils. And then the ratio of these things allows discrimination between nuclear recoil and electron recoil. And in some sense, what's going on is, for nuclear recoils, you don't get as much charge, if you like. You get the same amount of heat or phonons from both types of energy deposition. Another thing measuring two signals gives you is redundancy. You don't depend on just one signal to trigger, for example. Okay. That's the main theme. Now, we have a lot of permutations. There's actually two detector types. The first, where we have results that I'll show you, are the blips. And the second are called the zips, and I'll mention more about those. These ones are the ones that are used in the iteration of our detector known as CDMS-2. There's also two sites, a shallow site at Stanford and a deep site at Sudan that we're commissioning. We've been operating at Stanford for a long time. And, of course, the two materials. So there's a lot of permutations there. The results that we have are from blips in germanium at Stanford, and we're about to have results from zips at SUF at Stanford, and where there's both germanium and silicon, and we're getting to Sudan. Okay, so these are the sites. The Stanford site, not very deep, substantial flux of neutrons, therefore, and results. And we have to shield because we're so close to the surface. And the situation looks something like this. The Aleutian fridge, which has cooling that goes in and cools our detectors. And then around that, there's polyethylene and lead. And then around that is an active shield of scintillator. And it's real important. The scintillator veto is crucial in the experiment. WIMPs, of course, won't leave any trace in the shield outside the detector. And so when that's on, whatever we're seeing are not WIMPs. And when we don't see any pulse in the veto, then those are the WIMP candidates. But it's a nice control in various ways to look at the samples that have pulses in the veto. The Sudan site is being commissioned. Actually, here's part of the shielding there. Outer polyethylene, some lead, and in there is some archaeological lead taken from the Mediterranean, I guess. And then another bunch of polyethylene, and actually that's the mu metal shield, I guess, that would shield the detectors. It's much deeper, about a factor of 300 smaller neutron flux. And we're commissioning the fridge and should be operating this winter. So those are the sites. Detectors, the BLIP stands for Berkeley Large Ionization and Phonons, about a sixth of a kilogram germanium disk. And we see the heat or phonons with a thermistor very similar to Edelweiss. The thing is about this is that it's a slow signal. It takes milliseconds to develop the signal, and that time constant is determined by fundamental thermalization times and so forth. We ran through 1999 with four detectors. One of them was contaminated. Our results come from three. The other detectors, the ZIPs, measure Z, and our coordinate system, by the way, we have disks. Z is the thin direction of the disk, and X and Y are the Y direction of the pancakes. And so most of the surface is on the big flat part. If you want to discriminate edge versus middle, you want to discriminate Z. So that's why Z is so prominent and important. It is in the name ZIP. ZIP, Z ionization and phonons. A little more germanium, we also have silicon ones. And the way we detect phonons is totally different. We get the phonons on the fly, so to speak, before they thermalize. And we do that with a gadget known as a transition edge sensor. It's a little bit of metal held between superconducting and normal. And small bits of energy cause it to go very sensitively one way or the other. The signal here is very fast in distinction to the blip signal. Microseconds rather than milliseconds. And we image both, you know, in the big dimensions of the detectors and the small one. The way we get this thing Z is with actually the rise time of the signal. I'll show you the results from the performance of these guys at the Stanford site. We'll have results very soon, maybe at the end of this month, perhaps, where we've been operating four germanium and two silicon detectors. And the ultimate goal of this iteration, CDMS2, is to get 42 of these operating in the deep site. So that's an overview of the detectors. Oh yeah, both of them always measure ionization by drifting to electrodes with an applied electric field. It's incredibly small voltage, a couple volts drifts the ionization for you. Very different than room temperature silicon. So here's some pictures of the blips. The four of them, this is actually the side where the electrode is, and the copper shielding and services and stuff for the detectors. And the results are actually just the final iteration of a very long 40-page paper has just appeared on the AstroPH server, the final version of this paper. Okay, so there's a blip. It gives you the size. It's about 6 centimeters across. And the heat is measured with two thermistors, two for redundancy, sitting to the side. And then actually on the other side of the detector, there is a electrode that's segmented into inner and outer. The break is actually there. This other line tells you where the curve over from this view starts. So the outside line just tells you where the rounded corner starts. This is where the outer electrode is. Not significant because what's happened is our result from 2 years ago, we only used events that had all of their ionization on the inner electrode. And now our final results in August, we're using events that have pulses that are both in just the inner and shared And that combination is sometimes called QIS in our terminology. And so that adds a certain amount of exposure for us. Let me see. Oh yeah, here's just some pictures of the pulses from the thermistors. You can see the pulses are very long, milliseconds. Ionization has a much faster signal. The scale has been expanded a lot here compared to there as well. Okay, and that presents various problems, but okay. Calibration of these guys, well, here you see along the vertical is the ratio of the ionization to the heat measurement or phonon measurement, if you like. That's the horizontal, and the horizontal is recoil energy. And what you see are the response to an external source of photons and one of neutrons, and you can see there's a lot less ionization for a given amount of phonons for the neutrons. And the discrimination between blue and red is the discrimination, if you like. WIMPs will create signals very much like the neutrons. Now, a problem, one of the more prominent problems we have is if you have external electrons that enter the face of the detector, they will deposit their energy literally in microns near the surface. And some of their ionization in the end won't be collected. It gets trapped in the edges. And so if you use an external electron source, you can see you get less of the ionization, and actually external electrons can dribble down into the WIMP nuclear recoil region. Okay. Okay. And so that's an issue for us. And a lot of work has gone on to make the efficiency as high as possible here using amorphous silicon contacts and so forth. And there's similar experience in Edelweiss. This dribbling down of external electrons actually sets our energy threshold to be 10 keV. Our actual efficiency threshold is substantially lower than that, but that's why we use a threshold of 10 keV. Let me see. So here's some photons just to show you our energy resolutions, about a 10 keV photon, some other photons, the annihilation peak. Now, there's an interesting point here involving the ionizing backgrounds. This is data where we've asked for no pulses in the Vito shield and selected on the electron recoil or photon band, if you like. And this is, you know, absolute scale on the left. Energy is logarithmic, so there's a lot of, you know, four decades of energy there. And so you see some of the prominent peaks, but it's an interesting question. What is the background at our site, really? And there is reasonable evidence that it's somehow uranium-thorium contamination, because that cuts off at 2.6 MeV, and our spectrum tends to cut off there. So it's our internal photons from our internal radiation or internal contamination that are our ionizing background anyway. Okay, but then, by the way, so we're able to discriminate this again, okay, by about a factor of 1,000.
Get rid of it.
This is at Stanford, actually. This is at Stanford, but it's internal, so it's maybe not that different at Sudan. That's why I brought it up, actually. Okay.
You could use it for prospecting.
Yeah. Okay, so here's some neutron signals. Okay, now what we've done here is ask for there to be pulses in the Vito shield, so these can't be WIMPs. These are in the nuclear recoil band, and presumably from neutrons. And in fact, that's backed up. If you, the upper histogram is our inner and shared electrodes. The lower one is just the inner electrode. And the dotted or the dashed lines are from our simulation. This is an absolute scale. So, you know, the amount of neutrons we see for the Vito on events agree very well with what our simulation would predict. So we believe we have a good handle on what's happening with neutrons. Something about that, where the neutrons come from. Most of them, this is a plot of neutron energy and flux, and these are arbitrary units, but then you start to get in real absolute units down here, okay? So these are the spectrum of neutrons that eventually give us pulses in the detector, and this is their energy at birth, and you can see, the dashed line are ones that are created inside our detector region, you know, the box around our detector and shielding and so forth, and then external to the immediate region is the solid line, and then way out in the rock in the tunnel at Stanford are these. And so that's the production energy. By the time they're incident on the detector, they've usually had some scatter, so they've been convoluted down, and they've been softened substantially. Finally, when they make a recoil, you pretty much can't tell the difference between the source. So it's sort of almost a universal spectrum in recoil for neutrons. Okay. Okay. So, all right, so the data here, finally, when we ask that the Vito be clean, these are WIMP candidates, And if I just ask for events that have their ionization in the inner electrode, we see this recoil energy versus ionization yield. This is the WNT band here. There are 13 nuclear recoils. This is two-year-old data, essentially. What we've done is add another 4 kilogram days where the ionization is shared, and we have another 10 nuclear recoils. All of these are consistent with being neutrons because we're at a shallow site. There are checks on this. You can compare the multiple pulses with singles. And what's shown here, the crosses are the actual data. The circles are expectation from simulation. And for inner electrode shared, and then the combination of the two. And then you can do an exercise here where you use all the other numbers to predict this number, and that's what the shaded line. It's all consistent with being neutrons. Okay. One thing to point out is there's a short run where we had a silicon detector that is actually quite useful in constraining this. Everything's consistent with it being neutrons. Okay, so we have here's some fits to the energy spectrum. There's the energy spectrum itself. In the end, it's consistent with being neutrons. These are fits including some WIMPs. The blue line here is our exclusion plot. There's DAMA. There's the old Edelweiss curve. Now there's a little bit of explaining, because actually our new curve is somewhat worse than our old one, okay? And the main source of this is that in our neutron estimates, we had predicted in our old results somewhat more neutrons than we observed, so WIMPs were in some sense contributing a negative amount to our signal. And our quoted limit was actually not that near to our expected one. That's all sort of been resolved now, and our current limit is very close to the one you'd predict from running lots of Monte Carlos of a similar data set. The dotted line here is the predicted. The blue is what we achieve. And so things are very consistent now. Of course, what's happened is Edelweiss has somewhat more sensitivity and has excluded a bigger region, and we heard about that already. Okay. At our shallow site, we've added neutron shielding. That will reduce the neutron flux by about a factor of 2. Detector technology completely changed, and these are the CDMS2 zips. Four made out of germanium and 2 made out of silicon have been operating for not quite a year there. 27 kilogram days have been accumulated. It's great data. I'll show you some of it, and we'll have results later this year. But of course, because of the neutron flux, the real event is to get onto Sudan at a deeper site and then install 42 detectors over 3 years. So some of the, how do zips really work? On the surface of the detectors, they're superconducting aluminum, where phonons, when they impinge on that superconducting aluminum, bust up Cooper pairs. And that makes an excitation called a quasiparticle that eventually wander out to some tungsten. And then the tungsten is held right on the edge between normal and superconducting. And small amounts of energy cause great changes in the resistance. And so that's how those things work. And then eventually we get a small current that we measure with squids. There's what a zip sort of looks like. Those are all a bunch of little aluminum collection fins. And here's some of the details. There's a big aluminum collection fin, and actually the tungsten where we get temperature changes is actually a very small thing, just sort of a micron in size to make sure you get the best signal out of the small amount of energy. Okay, so here's what some of the pulses look like. There's the ionization pulse, which is fast. And what you see here are some of the phonon pulses, which are on the same time scale now. Actually, the surface of the detector is split into 4 segments, and these are the 4 phonon signals from the 4 segments. You can use those to determine the XY position where the event occurred, so image the event. And then the rise time of the phonon pulse gives you the up-down coordinate. And that's the most useful for rejecting things that come from the edge. Okay, so the rise time gives you Z. And so here's actually some data on that, some calibration. What's along the horizontal here is the ratio of ionization to phonons. So Compton electrons are here at 1. Nuclear recoils from a neutron source are down here at 0.3 or so. And these external electrons are somewhere in the middle. These guys occur near the edges of the detector, so they have very fast rise times, whereas WIMPs, for example, would occur throughout the detectors like neutrons and give you longer rise times. So this affords you extra discrimination against external events, and that's part of the beauty of these ZIPs. So here's some recent data, one of the fluorescent peaks, I guess, from gallium or germanium, I can't remember, okay. And then here is actual data with activity in the VITO, where you see ionizing events and the separation with nuclear recoils. And the thresholds can be very, very low here. There's huge numbers of events here, so these guys are not that, the ones that are dribbling through are not that considerable, actually. Okay, so that's the recent ZIP data. And we got to get to Sudan. Where will we get? Here are the current limits. There's 10 to the minus 42. Something like a factor of 100 or more when we're finally operating and assuming our backgrounds get to the level of 1/100th of an event per kilogram per day and getting exposure of 200 or so. So that's pretty much it. I guess I'll let Sydney Harris finish my talk and improve upon him, haha. Thank you very much. Well, one reason is that they're highly purified materials, so that you don't want radioactive impurities that have gotten into our environment since the atomic age in your detector, clearly. You want to have as little radioactive material as possible. So silicon and germanium are highly refined materials that are very radio pure. And actually, most of our metallic structure is built of copper for the same reason. Copper you can electroform, and it's incredibly free of radio impurities. So that's one of the main reasons, okay. There are other reasons in that it's a nice crystal and so forth, but I think that's probably the radio purity is the biggest single reason.
Well, I have a large number of questions, so maybe someone else might have them.
Yeah.
Yeah. So for sequence two, will you just be using germanium or also?
No, it's about half and half, because one of the big questions actually at Sudan is there's a lot of uncertainty about just what the neutron background really will be. I mean, we have some idea what the neutron flux is right now, but then we have our shield, and we also have this active VITO. And exactly knowing the efficiency of the VITO shield on neutron events, because the neutrons come from big events that leave splash and so forth, it's not that easy to really know. And so we're going to start out with about half silicon. It may change, but that's the plan. And the silicon will really just tell us what the neutron background that's in our search region is.
Well, that's your threshold, seems about 20 kilovolts.
Yeah, it's actually 10.
It looked like 20.
Let me see. We can go back. Okay, it depends on which one. This one. Okay, so these are the this is the result. And this line is actually at 10. And it's actually not a line determined by efficiency of the trigger or anything. It's a choice because we've got these surface events leaking down. Yeah. In any case, actually, if anything, now that we've changed to the ZIPs, it'll, what, was that the one you wanted to see? Or? Okay, that's probably Edelweiss, okay? That's Edelweiss. But I think the principle is similar, that it's where this dribbles down is where you set your analysis, your search region. Yeah, that's right. And actually, that's reflected in these curves by our limit is a little tighter at lower WIMP masses, okay, or more restrictive, I guess. Okay.
Yeah. I had another question.
Well, it's actually a series of questions. It's probably better if I ask them.
That'd be great, Mika.
Well, why don't we thank Harry? Okay.